From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump visits a Border Patrol station in McAllen, Texas today as he considers declaring a national emergency to bypass Congress and enlist the military to build his wall. Maybe his last option to get what he wants and end the 20-day government shutdown, because talks with Congress collapsed yesterday when Trump said bye-bye and walked out of his meeting with Democratic leaders Pelosi and Schumer. The two sides can't even agree if Trump pounded the table as he exited. Trump spoke this morning on his way to Texas.
Compromise is in my vocabulary very strongly. So we're either going to have a win, make a compromise, because I think a compromise is a win for everybody, or I will declare a national.
NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley has been following all of this. And Scott, take that sentence there. What does the president mean by compromise in that sentence? Him? Them? Is there negotiating?
You know, I think the operative word in that sentence, Robin, is not compromise, but win. Mm-hmm. That's what the president's looking for here. Remember, there was a compromise. The House and Senate had agreed on a spending bill back before Christmas. The president was on board, supposedly, to sign it. And then some mean girls on talk radio suggested he was wimping out, and he blew it up. And that's how we got the government shutdown. So what he wants now is a win, or at least to give the impression to immigration hardliners that he's playing hardball.
Okay, and talk about a national emergency. We've been going over it, but first of all, do you think he will call for, what's your sense of whether he will call for one?
You know, the president keeps saying that it's on the table, but he repeated this morning that he's not prepared to go that route yet. On the one hand, it may be the only sort of face-saving way out of this spending stalemate between the president and the Democrats. On the other hand, there are some risks associated with it. It would almost certainly invite a legal challenge. And even some of the president's Republican allies on the Hill are resistant, either because they don't like the idea of diverting military funding to a border wall, or because they don't like the idea of, you know, short-circuiting congressional control of the purse strings.
Yeah, my Democrats lose out as well, because they almost seem daring him to do this. But then they lose any leverage they might have had to get a deal on protections from deportation for young undocumented immigrants brought here when they were children.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they're really trying to get that kind of DACA deal. That idea has been floated a number of times, but it never seems to have gotten any traction. And they remember all too well a year ago when they thought they had a deal to trade wall funding for some DACA relief. And again, the president and immigration hardliners pulled the plug on it.
Well, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke on the Senate floor this morning. He's saying, you know, our position is separate our disagreements over border security from the government shutdown, reopen the government, and then continue to resolve our differences. That's already been thrown out by the president. But we're not hearing that much from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. What's going on there?
No, we're hearing almost nothing from Mitch McConnell. He has spoken on the floor of the Senate in sort of his institutional role, but he has been invisible on all the occasions when Republicans have lined up alongside the president. He is certainly helping the president by refusing to bring a bill to the Senate floor to reopen the government without the president's okay. But Mitch McConnell has certainly not been photographed with his, you know, arm around the president. He's trying to keep his distance a little bit.
Another story we're following is the news that his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, shared campaign polling data with a Russian connected to the Kremlin. This is the first time he's spoken about that. Here's an exchange with ABC's John Carl. Let's listen.
Sorry, President, did you know that Paul Manafort was sharing polling data from your campaign with the Russians?
No, I didn't know anything about it. Nothing about
Mr. President.
It.
And just, Scott, how's that going to play out? He's, of course, distracting from that by going to Texas.
Well, so the president there saying that he was not aware of the polling data that Manafort was sharing with Russians. Of course, what the candidate knew and when he knew it is at the heart of the investigation that's being carried out by the special counsel. And you hear there a pretty straightforward denial by President Trump that he was aware that that sharing was going on. I have to say, though, I remember when President Trump denied knowing about hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. So Donald Trump's word on this may not be the final word.
NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, the Supreme Court has been back in session this week, and for the first time since her confirmation in 1993, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg hasn't been there. She is still recovering from cancer surgery. This week also included the first opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, which, in contrast to his contentious confirmation hearing, was notably without controversy. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
So the actual decision Kavanaugh was writing for was unanimous. Uncontroversial. Is that by design?
Yes. By tradition, the newest justice, the junior justice, for his first or her first opinion, is assigned a unanimous opinion, one that's not terribly difficult, so that individual can start out with a relatively easy assignment, and that's what this was. This was a 9-0 decision on a rather technical legal point involving a question of the Federal Arbitration Act.
And is Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, who would have assigned Kavanaugh to write this opinion, is he treating Kavanaugh differently, do you think, than other justices, other new justices?
No. I think, as far as I could see, it's the same. But, of course, we don't know what goes on behind those red velvet curtains in the court that we see in the courtroom. And I think it's pretty clear that the Chief Justice would like this to be as uncontroversial a term as possible. And so far, he's succeeded at that. It's not entirely clear that he will be able to continue to succeed because the Trump administration keeps leapfrogging the normal appellate process and bringing very controversial issues where it's lost in the lower courts up to the court and saying, please stay what the lower court did, block what the lower court did, and hear this case. And so far, it's been unsuccessful in that. But, you know, you never can tell.
How concerned is Chief Justice Roberts right now about just the image of the court after the Kavanaugh confirmation?
He's very concerned, and so is every other member of the court. And so all the other justices who have been out on the talking to various legal groups have made a point of saying that they respect their colleagues. They do not think that this is a partisan institution. They may have their ideological differences, but not their partisan, that partisanship doesn't reflect that. And even Kavanaugh at one point tried to walk back some of the more partisan things he said at his confirmation hearing. He said, perhaps I shouldn't have said that in one of his public outings.
Mm-hmm. What about his voting record so far? There was the Planned Parenthood cases. The Chief Justice and Kavanaugh sided with the liberals on the court in passing on taking a pair of cases. This was seen as kind of interesting that he sided with the liberals.
Right. But this is not a question on the merits. This is a very technical question where two lower courts had said, yes, Medicaid recipients can challenge a state's laws barring individual providers like Planned Parenthood from receiving federal aid. So this is a very technical question, and they took it up to the Supreme Court, and the court passed on it 6-3. Justice Ginsburg voted from her hospital bed on the day she had surgery. She participated in that case and also voted in that case. The only one in which Kavanaugh has sided with the conservatives and Roberts, the Chief Justice, sided with the liberals, again, to prevent a case from being heard, was one of the asylum cases that came up to the court. That doesn't mean these cases won't come back. It just means that for now, they're passing on them.
Mm-hmm. What about Justice Ginsburg? How's she doing now? She's been absent from the court this week.
You know, it's probably good for her that she didn't decide to sit on the bench. She is participating in cases by reading the briefs and reading a transcript of the oral argument. And the Chief Justice says that every day just before the oral argument, mm-hmm. that she'll participate. So she's working from home. But, you know, when I was researching the thoracic surgery that she had, what all the leading surgeons that I spoke to said is you can get back to work within 2 weeks, which is what she would have had to do. But you want to be careful not to take one step forward and five steps back. So she's not, probably, would be my guess, is not going to sit at this sitting, which is a 6 days over 2 weeks. But after that, there's also a 3.5-week gap. It's called the writing period for the winter session. And I would imagine that she'll use that time to recoup and that she'll be back in February.
Well, and I'm sure this is very difficult for her after watching the documentary RBG, which you are basically a co-star of. It's clear that she is a workaholic. She does not like missing anything when it comes to her work.
Well, that's true. But this is the better part of valor, to stay home, mm-hmm. get strong, and come back. And yes, her record is broken, but it's a big deal. You know, so what? You know, if she had gone to court, and we had a conversation like this in the press room, if she had been there, she'd sort of toughed it out and gone and had hesitated at all in a question or seemed to get very tired or looked terribly wan, we would have all written about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, dear. La, da, 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 da. And so it was probably smart to stay home.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, I have not yet seen On the Basis of Sex, the new movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I did see RBG, and if you haven't seen that, check it out. Let's take a break from the news now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Aaron Bird is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us once again. Aaron, welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, man. It's always nice to hear your voice.
You too. And let's get to some of the music that you brought us today. This is D'Angelo. This is called Unshaken.
He who drinks from the deep water, may he know the depths of the well.
Listen to that bass. And this song actually is apparently part of the soundtrack to the video game Red Dead Redemption 2.
That's right. I guess Rockstar, who produces Red Dead Redemption, solved a puzzle that many of us have tried to figure out in a long time. How is it that you get D'Angelo to make music? Apparently, you create a video game that he's a big, big fan of. And apparently, that is the genesis of this song. He frequented the offices, and so much so, became on a first-name basis with some of the producers and programmers of the game, and eventually led to them offering an opportunity to have a song on the soundtrack.
You know, we just did an entire DJ session all about music that was being made for video games. So now I know. I didn't know before. It's like cinema. It's like they're doing a movie soundtrack now. They're getting big stars. They're getting big orchestras to put together these soundtracks for video games. Let's talk about this one, though. D'Angelo had a long period where he wasn't releasing albums in the early 2000s. He had some problems with substance abuse, but he's been putting out music in the past few years. How would you describe what he's doing now?
Well, the last release was his album that just sort of dropped out of nowhere at the end of 2014. And as you mentioned, he went, I want to say it was about 14 years without releasing anything of substance. And I don't know what has happened, but whatever has happened, I think all of us who are fans of good music and certainly fans of D'Angelo are really happy and pleased with it. This song is one of the most unique, I think, that we've probably heard from him. Who would have ever imagined D'Angelo doing a Western song?
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't care what type of cuisine you love. You will always have a taste for D'Angelo. And he sounds good no matter what he seems to do.
Okay, the next one is a French-Canadian musician, Marie Davidson. This is called L'Extase.
L'Extase. À New York. À 6 heures du matin. Je m'amuse, la sueur sur son front, le lever du soleil sur ses paupières, à l'essai d'un matin, midi verte, comment? À l'essai d'un matin, midi verte.
Tell us about this one.
I don't know about you, but when I hear it, it immediately transports me to a certain time at night in a certain location, perhaps involving extracurriculars, is what I like to say. Marie has a really incredible mastery of capturing that particular sound, especially this specific sound you would hear, I would say, late night in Berlin. There's a really famous club called the Berghain. And to contextualize this, the Berghain opens up at like 2 a.m., technically Saturday morning, and closes sometime on Monday morning. And I've been to this club, people will enter the club with duffel bags, the duffel bags having their clothes to go to work in on Monday. This specific song, I think, reminds me of a moment I've had in Berghain in particular, where you realize you've probably been there too long, but the wave has already crested and it's way too late. So you just keep going along with the and riding the wave. And she is just a master at capturing that sound and that feeling.
I know that there are so many NPR listeners listening to this right now saying, yeah, me too. I've had that exact same experience at that club in Berlin. Okay, let's get to the next one. This is the London musician Arlo Parks, who is just 18 years old. This is the song Cola. So take your orchids elsewhere. I'm always surprised when I hear people and find out that they're just 18 or 17 or whatever and have a voice like that.
It's incredible, man. As you mentioned, just 18 years old, a British singer who's actually half Nigerian, half Chadian, I believe is how you pronounce it. One of her parents is from Chad. And I have to admit, I literally just discovered her last week, maybe just mere hours before my show. And the song and the content, I would say, is evident of someone who's had experience that goes beyond just the 18 revolutions around the sun. You know, she talks about a conflicting feeling of a cheating lover. And that's what this song is all about.
Okay, so Arlo Parks, you heard it here first. Unless you were listening to Aaron's show on KCRW and then you heard it there first and here the second time. The next one that you brought us is the French artist, Kitty Smile. This is called House of God. Very interesting. What's going on here? Who is this?
Kitty Smile has described himself as black, Arabic, and gay. He's from Paris, and as you might imagine, having those different characteristics, forms of identity has led to quite a challenging life, and I'm sure in many instances, one of confused identity. He got into the Paris ballroom scene and fell in love with dance and found inspiration from artists like Sylvester and Grace Jones. And through this, developed a level of confidence, and he's become a really inspiration and leader in many ways in the LGBTQ community.
And tell us more about what he does here, what he's doing with the music.
The music is, I think for many people, probably will remind them of house music that you would hear during the Vogue scene of the 90s in house music, which has been, and historically, to be completely honest, has been really dominated and been birthed out of the black male gay scene. Hmm. And he's just continuing this tradition.
Okay, before you go, Aaron, we've got time for one more. This is the Canadian indie electro-pop band Men I Trust with Show Me How. So after the party at the Berlin nightclub, when you've got your clothes that's in the duffel bag and you're putting them back on and going to work, this is what you hear to just sort of chill out.
Yeah, Men I Trust has become a little bit of a fascination here at the station. Now, I must say, I can't remember how many times I've been on the show with you now, but it's been several times over the last 3, 4, maybe even 5 years. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time I've actually included a song that isn't very new. And they come out with a song. It's a, first of all, a trio from Montreal. They've come out with a song called Say Can You Hear? And through my love for that song, which sounds just very, very different from this one, Show Me How, I discovered Show Me How, which came out almost a year ago. And Say Can You Hear Me is a great song. But Show Me How is almost like a perfect song. It's just an amazing groove. I love the dreamy, melodic vocals. That bass line is so seductive. And I really went back and forth between choosing one of their songs that's a bit more recent or this song. And I opted for the one that I just actually have a little bit more of affinity for.
Well, I love it. And all the music you brought us is great. People can find it at hereandnow.org. Also on our Spotify playlist, just search for NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music. Aaron Bird, DJ at KCRW, thanks as always.
Man, thank you, Jeremy. Take care.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Just a minute now on the NFL playoffs, mainly so we can say double doink. Of course, I am talking about the Chicago Bears' Cody Parker's potential game-winning kick for a field goal and a win against the Philadelphia Eagles. Thank goodness this is radio. We don't have to see it again. Here we go.
Parkey lines it up. O'Donnell on one knee. Gives him a look, extends his right arm. Scales sends it back. Placement made. Kick from 43. And it hit the upright. It is no good on the crossbar. And the Eagles are celebrating here at Soldier Field.
It hit the upright. Then it hit the crossbar, the dreaded double doink. So that was Bears radio. Here's Eagles radio.
Ball is snapped, placed, kicked, and it is... It is no good. Oh. The Eagles win.
Mike Pesca, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast at justatslate.com. He joins us now. 1615 Eagles. There's also an Hispanic radio version. I urge everyone to listen to it. But a double doink, your thoughts?
Just from a broadcasting perspective, I'd give the edge to the Bears. A lot more description there.
Yes. Rather,
although you could, you know, the terseness of the one word ball snapped. Now, to the dry, I also love the double doink, which means you hit the crossbar and the goalpost.
Right, right.
The goalposts are 18.6 inches across and have a thickness of 5 inches. And, you know, if it was 1 inch or maybe 1.5 inch or a different rotation, it goes in. Or then when it hits the crossbar, same deal.
Well, and it's hard to hit if you were trying.
Yeah. And also, also, what we found out later was the Eagle defender got a hand on the ball, so he might have helped it to that last inch. But there's so much more than one kick. The kick and Cody Parkey, I guess the Steve Bartman of the foot in Chicago now, as the guy to blame. But, you know, the Eagles scored on a fourth down with a minute left. That was the game right there. The Bears failed to convert a two-point conversion. So many things can happen in a game that comes down to a double doink.
Yeah, and you know what, Cody? It will. You'll be okay. All right, then.
Or
although
cut.
I have no proof
it's
of that.
It's an unforgiving sport.
Right, okay. Take a look at this weekend quickly. The Indianapolis Colts play the Chiefs in Kansas City. The Dallas Cowboys take on the Rams in Los Angeles. Quick thoughts on Saturday's games.
Sure. Kansas City and Indianapolis, those quarterbacks have combined for 89 thrown touchdowns. Kansas City, an amazing offense. First team to lose a game and score more than 50 points, but the Colts line is playing well. I don't know if the Dallas Cowboys will have enough to beat the L.A. Rams, and I do think that Nick Foles' heroism, Super Bowl MVP Nick Foles, maybe runs out of heroism, because when the Saints are in their dome, they're extremely hard to beat. I'll take a bite of the last team, which is the L.A. Chargers against the New England Patriots, the last game.
Right.
I mean, you
Sunday.
Tell me. The New England Patriots, come on. You're going to pick against them?
Not me, but yeah. Others happily do.
Yeah, well, I think the difference is, of all the teams we've listed, there are just so many great quarterbacks. Maybe Foles isn't great, but he is a Super Bowl MVP. Dallas and Dak Prescott are good, but I don't know if he's great. And quarterback greatness is usually what carries a team through the playoffs.
Okay, real quick, how are the playoffs so far?
They've been extremely entertaining and exciting, and I think with the resurgence of the Colts, that could be one of the most exciting, highest scoring games in NFL playoff history.
You are such a double doink.
Mike
Preska, Here Now Sports Analyst. Thanks so much.
Cleaning through the uprights.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
President Trump speaking today on day 20 of the government shutdown over funding for a wall on the southern border. This is on track to become the longest shutdown in history on Saturday when we reach day 22. Shutdowns like this one are a relatively modern phenomenon. The first one ever was in 1980. So whose idea was it to close the federal government when lawmakers and the president couldn't agree on how to fund it? And how did they settle those disputes before? For answers, let's bring in historians Brian Ballow and Joanne Freeman, hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back to you both.
Thanks
Good
for
to
having
be here.
Us.
So, Joanne, we mentioned that government shutdowns have only been happening for a few decades, but you say that our early federal government may as well have been shut down because it wasn't getting a whole lot done.
Well, it was certainly really small, right? The historian John Murin described the early federal government as a midget institution in a giant land. So the whole government was small. The administrative state was really tiny. A great example of this is what would happen in the course of wars, like the War of 1812 or the Civil War. You would have the army built up for the purpose of war and then largely demobilized once the war was done because it wasn't needed anymore. Mm-hmm. So let's make it smaller. I'd say the two ways in which the government most reached out in this period would have been customs houses at ports that were collecting customs duties and the post office, which to some people at the time would have seemed like it was the government.
Brian, there were some early examples of lawmakers going AWOL at times when they were needed.
Well, not just lawmakers, but actually the Secretary of War. I mean, we have this great story about a Frenchman who had fought with Lafayette in the American Revolution, and he pays a visit to the Secretary of War in Washington, D.C. Now, Washington, D.C. was pretty new in 1796. Anyway, he expects to see a sentinel, nobody there, walks into the building. He sees two clerks, and he says, "I'm here to meet with the Secretary of the War." And, you know, they say, "Sorry, he's getting a shave at his neighbor's house." So I think he was even more appalled, this Frenchman, when he learned that those two clerks were the War Department. That was it.
They said, "He'll come back if you build a wall."
Oh.
So to early Americans, therefore, the idea of shutting down the federal government as a political maneuver wouldn't have made a lot of sense.
Yeah, it was pre-shutdown, if you want.
Well, certainly they wouldn't have gotten it in the way that we're experiencing it now, just as you're saying, as some kind of grand political gesture that's supposed to have a big impact. I mean, they understood at the time things like congressional log jams and, you know, the government being sort of stuck on an issue for a long time. But as far as a shutdown, it's just that the government was so small. It's not as though what we're calling this grand shutdown really would have had much of an impact. I mean, just look at Washington, D.C. at the turn of the 19th century. It was basically a handful of big government buildings scattered amidst lots of vacant plots of land and some small wooden buildings. Someone at the time said that Washington looked as if the British Museum suddenly migrated to the center of an exhausted brick field. Hmm. So, you know, it's not the metropolis that we imagine it today. And as far as the number of people in the federal government, around the time when Thomas Jefferson assumed office, so right at the turn of the 19th century, there were only 153 federal employees working in Washington. And over the next 30 years, although the nation's population increased 150%, that number barely doubled.
So what did they do, though, about funding disputes when the White House and lawmakers were not on the same page?
Well, sometimes they bargained. You know, I mean, if you want to go down to the first—
That sounds awfully old-fashioned, Joanne.
I know. Silly me, that whole debate and compromise thing. But it's true that, you know, if you go all the way back to the first Congress, you had essentially the ultimate logjam in Congress over Hamilton's financial plan. And the way that that was resolved was a backroom bargain. I mean, that's actually the room where it happened in the Hamilton
musical.
Oh,
there you go.
There
Yeah,
it
a
is.
More dramatic example. I totally agree with Joanne, but a dramatic example was President Jackson, who hated the Bank of the United States. And when Congress rechartered the bank, its charter was going to expire, Jackson just vetoed it. But that wasn't enough. He then withdrew all of the U.S. funds from the Bank of the United States because the bank still had another couple of years before it would have come to an end. So they did stuff like that.
Now, take us a little bit closer to the present, Brian. The government gets a lot bigger. It takes on more and more responsibilities. And then in the Carter administration, they decide that the government will shut down if Congress and the president can't agree on how to fund it. How exactly did that happen?
Well, in the past, Congress had been a little late, let's say, with appropriating funds. But the government had not shut down. Workers stayed in their jobs, and they got paid pretty quickly, and they did their work. Now, you have to remember, Jeremy, that what a lot of this is about in the recent times is really a tug of war, a partisan war. We're seeing that play out right now, of course. And Congress and the presidents were often very much the same after the New Deal, and Congress was virtually always Democratic. But under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, and a Democratic Congress, Carter's attorney general stumbled across an old law from the 19th century that said, no, you actually have to shut down the government if there's not an appropriation. And there was a one-day shutdown, one day because, in fact, they were from the same party, Congress and the president, but a one-day shutdown, and the Federal Trade Commission had to start packing up their files. They canceled their court hearings, and Congress appropriated the money, and the next day they were back at work.
But you're saying this is all because of an old law from the 19th century?
It's an interpretation. Benjamin Civiletti, Carter's attorney general, looked at this law, and he said, no, wait a second. You know, we actually have to fine the head of an agency if they operate once the appropriation has expired. Hmm. And that got their attention.
So what about when we get closer to the present? 1995, this is the shutdown that everybody talks about. This was the longest one. Newt Gingrich leading Congress and Bill Clinton in the White House. A tussle between the president and the House played out through the longest government shutdown ever.
That's right. Note, we now have the first Republican Congress in decades, headed by a guy who was pretty determined to shake things up in the Congress, Newt Gingrich. He was also determined to slash government spending. And he said, we're going to close this deficit. We're going to slash programs like Medicaid and Medicare. And Bill Clinton said, no, you're not. And they duked it out for 3 weeks. And that was the first time that the government was shut down for a prolonged basis and that people's pay was delayed. 800,000 workers, similar to the number of workers out right now, were affected by this.
But the thing is, and this gets to the point of do we ever learn from history, Newt Gingrich looks back on that and says that was a huge political mistake. It did not work out well for him, and yet here we are again. Why has nobody learned that lesson?
Well, you know, Jeremy, you always feel it's the other guy who's going to get it in the neck, right? I mean, actually, Bill Clinton came out of that smelling like roses.
Now, Joanne, when you look around the world, do other countries do this? Do they have government shutdowns when they can't reach a deal on funding?
Well, I don't know if this will or won't surprise you, Jeremy, but the short answer to that question is no. Other countries don't do it in quite the same way that we do. I mean, they certainly have standoffs and strikes, but as far as a shutdown where entire institutions of government are shut down and employees don't get paid, that's really more of an American tradition, as short-lived as it might be. In other countries, when you have that kind of a financial disagreement and a budget or some kind of a financial arrangement is voted down, that's often taken as a vote of no confidence. And then you're talking about a change of government. So the United States is special in this unique shutdown tradition.
So they use the metric system. They have Coca-Cola with sugar in it instead of high fructose corn syrup and no government shutdowns. Okay.
There it goes.
There we are. Joanne Freeman and Brian Ballow, hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks as always. And hopefully next time we talk to you, the government will have reopened.
Thank you,
Jeremy.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke at the American University in Cairo today. That city was also the setting for President Obama's famous speech in 2009, in which he offered a new beginning for global Muslim-U.S. relations. Here's part of Obama's 2009 speech at Cairo University.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
Well, today, Pompeo didn't name Obama, but slammed his speech and subsequent policies, saying they've led to the rise of ISIS and Iran, painting Obama as wishful thinking, timid, and naive.
The good news is this. The age of self-inflicted American shame is over, and so are the policies that produce so much needless suffering. Now comes the real new beginning.
NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is traveling with Secretary Pompeo. She joins us from Cairo. Michelle, this was scorching. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, on the one hand, it's not surprising to hear Secretary Pompeo criticize the Obama administration. I mean, he does that a lot. But to hear it in this form, in this speech where he didn't even mention Obama's name, was pretty striking. As you said, he accused the former president of wishful thinking. It said it hurt America's interests in the region, that, you know, we were distant from our longtime friends and instead trying to focus only on Iran and negotiating the Iran nuclear deal, which, of course, the Trump administration has withdrawn the U.S. from. So, you know, we've heard the criticisms before, but to hear it in this form and here in Cairo was pretty striking.
And again, he didn't name Obama. He said the American who stood before me and spoke with you. And we know that Pompeo's chief goal this week was to reassure allies after the president tweeted out that he was going to bring all American troops home from Syria. Of course, there's been frantic backpedaling on that with John Bolton trying to negotiate some sort of deal with the Turks to protect the Kurds in Syria. So that's all backdrop for this speech. But that tweet left, you know, Israel in particular feeling there was no protection, no U.S. troops between that country and Iran across Syria. So here's Pompeo today.
President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. But this isn't a change of mission. We remain committed to the complete dismantling of ISIS, the ISIS threat, and the ongoing fight against radical Islamism in all of its forms.
But Michelle, how does that square? You have Pompeo slamming the Obama administration, which was criticized for not doing more in Syria, while the Trump administration is saying it's planning to pull troops out of Syria, and the president says that he is a nationalist and doesn't want to get involved in global conflicts and wants other countries to step up more. How is Pompeo presenting his administration as being tougher than Obama's?
Well, I mean, that's the problem. And this trip comes just as he's trying to explain to people, well, you know, this move from Syria is a tactical decision. It's not, you know, we do have other tools to fight ISIS, and we're going to continue to crush ISIS, he said today. But that is the problem, is that, you know, President Trump changes his mind a lot, right? I mean, he gave generals, he said, more time in Syria. They actually had a policy in Syria, and then suddenly he says, nope, no more time. We're pulling out. So, you know, here's Pompeo trying to reassure allies. We're here. We're back. We're in the region. But they're looking at this administration and seeing very different signals coming from it.
Well, I was going to say, what are you hearing? I mean, do U.S. allies in the region believe their ears are today or their eyes?
I think that's a big question they have. I did talk briefly to a former Egyptian foreign minister who was in the audience, and he said he was mostly like, you know, I hear the message. It's all about Iran. It's all about security. But there was a lot missing in the speech. And, you know, it was a lot about American politics, of course, too. But there was a lot missing in the speech. And one thing he mentioned was, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which Pompeo made kind of passing reference to, but didn't really talk to at all. But that's, of course, another lingering issue in this region.
Well, and just your sense of, I'm not sure if you've had time to speak with people, and because you've been talking to people like us, but your sense of the effect of slamming President Obama in Cairo. I mean, how does that go? How does that go over?
Well, Obama administration officials are kind of furious about this. They're just saying, you know, it looked like it ignored the facts that of things like the war in Iraq, Abu Ghraib. You know, there were reasons why Obama was reaching out to the Muslim world at that moment, at that time.
Abu Ghraib, the pictures that came out of the prison of U.S. soldiers torturing detainees.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and even now today, you have, you know, the U.S. is backing Saudi Arabia, which has led this disastrous war in Yemen, where it's the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yet the only mention that he had of Yemen today was about Iranian influence in Yemen. So, again, you know, giving a pass to our allies and partners in the region.
Fascinating day. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in Cairo, where Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke today. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.